Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Dinah Jeffries, how would you describe yourself?
I have two grandchildren, one of six and one of two. I live in Gloucestershire with my husband and a rather overweight Norfolk Terrier. And my first book is being published right now by Penguin. So, in a nutshell, that's me.
Excellent. And it's called The Separation.
It's called The Separation. And I was interested, actually, because I looked at your website today and saw that it's a place where women do the talking. Mm-hmm. Well, my book is set at a time and in a place where women most certainly didn't do the talking. And because of it, a lot of events take place which cause a lot of trouble for the woman and child involved.
Yes. Well, the whole line of three generations of women had sort of decisions made for them and their voices not heard, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. And my character... In fact, there are two main characters in the book, the mother, who is Lydia, and the elder daughter, Emma, and it's dual narrative. So you're seeing what is happening through the mother's eyes, but also separately through the daughter's eyes, because it is a separation of a mother from her two daughters. She doesn't know where they are. They're missing. So all along, the reader actually knows more than either the mother or the daughter. And while the mother is very much a woman... of the 1950s, where women knew their place and definitely spent their lives cleaning behind the fridge, as UKIP would like to think we should all return to. And Emma is very much represents the future. By the end of the novel, she's 15, and it's 1958, and you get a hint of what's to come, the 1960s, and how it would all change, thank goodness.
Yes. I sort of saw it as a... You know, for Emma, for the daughter, sort of coming of age story for her.
Yes.
And for Lydia, it was sort of a self-consciousness, you know, not coming of age, but coming into her own.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, interestingly, it's caused some divided opinions in Germany because it's been out in four European countries before being published in England next week. And some people in Germany... Although on the whole people liked it, but some people found Lydia too dependent and without enough independence. But I think she's very typical of a married colonial woman who, you know, she didn't even have a bank account of her own. In those days, you had to ask your husband's permission for all sorts of things, including that. And I think perhaps younger women don't really realise that in the 60 years, and it is 60 years ago, how much has changed for women. And whilst there is still a long way to go in some ways, it's just incomparable.
Yeah, I mean, I did find her... I mean, okay, so let's set the scene a little bit. We'll go back a little bit, because it does take place in Malaya. In the 1950s, Lydia is very much lives a colonial existence.
That's right.
She grew up in a convent, so she was a unwanted child.
Yeah.
So grew up in a convent, not knowing her parentage, and sort of in that innocence or naivete, you know, meets a man at a dance. You know, World War II veteran. And goes out to Malaya, adventure, and you follow your husband, and that's what you do. And it was very much a colonial existence, cocktails and dances and things like that. Is that a good summation?
Yes, I mean, it was. In fact, that is exactly what happened to my mother. That my mother and father went out to Malaya in 1947 or 1946, just after the war ended, but before the emergency was declared. And... It was a strange place to be thrown into because it was a tropical paradise. They did live a very privileged lifestyle in many ways, although neither of my parents came from a moneyed background. But once the emergency began, it became a very dangerous place. There were ambushes, there were fires, there were shootings, there were road mines. And, I mean, I grew up very used to guns. My father went out every single day with two Malayan armed policemen. And I often saw guns on the hall table when the rubber planters would come into town for a party or something like that. And it was a dangerous life for my father because he used to say he didn't know who he was most in fear of. The Chinese communists who were hidden in the jungles, and they were fighting the British administration. But they weren't actually fighting for independence, or not only independence. The communists in the jungle, the ones that became called terrorists, insurgents, guerrillas, they were fighting for communism. They wanted to turn Malaya into a communist state. Well, a lot of Malaya didn't want that, not just the Brits, the Chinese, the Indians, a lot. So it wasn't a straightforward struggle for independence. That was already underway, and the British already knew they were going to have to give up their little jewel, so to speak.
So the emergency was not the process of handing over, you know, independence to Malaya, but it was sort of an internal struggle as well.
Yes, I mean, the process of handing over independence took a few years, and I think it was 1957 that it finally happened, but the actual emergency didn't end until 1960, when the British were no longer there. It was a complex time, and in fact it was the period in which the phrase winning the hearts and minds was first coined by Gerald Templer, who was in charge and who really won the whole situation, if you talk about winning, by doing that. And it was mainly through intelligence and bribery and so on. I think it was Winston Churchill who said, you know, what happens in Malaya today, tomorrow the world. So it was an interesting period of time. And there was a lot of anti-Japanese feeling, you have to remember as well, because this was only 3 years after a really brutal Japanese occupancy, in which it's well known, anybody who's seen the Railway Man will know that. And it wasn't just the British who suffered, all the Europeans. The Chinese probably suffered more under the Japanese occupancy than anybody. But, you know, there was a lot of anti-Japanese feeling during my childhood, and given that it was so soon after the Second World War. In fact, the rumblings for it had begun before the Second World War, when the Chinese were beginning to fight for better conditions, quite rightly too. But then came the war, and some of the Chinese joined forces with the British to fight the Japanese, and so the British armed them. And then when the Japanese, after Hiroshima, after the Japanese left, the Chinese thought, ooh, goody, we've got all these armaments, we'll take them. So they took them to the jungles, didn't give them back, and buried them, you know, dismembered them, or whatever the right word is. And
dismantled.
Dug pits and hid them until such time as the emergency proper began. And it was only called an emergency rather than a war, so that the tin mine owners and the rubber plant owners in Britain could still claim against their losses.
Ah, because otherwise it would be an act of war.
Yeah.
And then,
That's right.
Interesting. And that still goes on today. I mean, you know, Afghanistan is a case in point of where we gave arms and they were like, oopsie, you're using them against us.
Yeah. You know? Maybe that was a mistake.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
RadioGorgeous.com.
But your father was... You moved around quite a bit, but he was very fond of his time there in Malaya.
Yes, he really enjoyed. I mean, he was a typical 1950s man, you know, sport, job, outdoor life, a man's man. You know, women looked after children. You know, men had careers, women had children. Mm-hmm. I think that's even in the book somewhere. But
yeah.
That was very much the case of a lot of 1950s men. And when he came back to England, of course, that incredible outdoor life wasn't really there anymore.
Mm.
You can't have the same kind of outdoor life in Britain with the rain and the cold. So, yeah, and I mean, you know, he wasn't the only one that missed Malaya. I missed it too. I missed the holidays we spent on tropical islands where the launch would just drop us and we had a wonderful time for 2 or 3 weeks. The monkeys, the spiders in the bathroom, we had to watch out every time we went to the loo, we didn't sit on a banana spider. We moved every year, but every time there were just very colourful gardens because, of course, everything grew so big and so rapidly. And I love watching the gardeners skinning up the palm trees to chop down the coconuts. And so we had fresh coconut and fresh coconut juice. And it was a wonderful childhood, despite what was really going on.
Mm.
And I tried to create that in the book. I tried to show that.
Yes. And I think your decision not to do any further research on what it was like and really delve into your own memories as a child of what it was like really creates such a richness. There's a, there's a palpable, tangible feeling to your descriptions of Malaya.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I've talked to my mother, unfortunately now her memory's going, but prior to writing the book, I talked to her a lot about her memories, and we went through all her photograph albums and wonderful pictures of, some of them a bit blurred, black and white, but wonderful pictures of the past, and that was very helpful in creating the locations and giving the, creating the sense of period and place.
Yeah. And so what the book does bear in that stamp is the, born in Malaya and this colonial lifestyle. But the story of Lydia and Emma is not your own. You were not separated from your parents.
No, we all came back together. Mm. They are fictional characters and it is a fictional story. I've merely borrowed some of my memories of living in Malaya as a child in the 50s and handed them to my character Emma. Fairly near the beginning, she talks about going into a museum and seeing the Second World War waxworks. I don't know if you noticed that bit or have read it, but and actually I did see that. I did see the women and children tied to the ground and the, the machine coming towards them.
Yeah. Oof.
So,
brutal.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of little bits and pieces. And also the other thing was, you're very aware of a spiritual, mythical, kind of strange undercurrent to Chinese and Malayan life, which is not at all English, which in a way I tried to get across a little bit in Emma's memories, of...
The gardener's stories, yeah.
Yeah, and burying bowls of rice to appease the spirit world and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Terribly miserable and cold and dangerous, and she's exposed to quite a big danger without her mother there to intervene.
Yes. And boarding school and hideous food.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You talk about the fresh coconut juice.
Yeah, and in fact, I had a chat with a woman who also was born and brought up in Malaya, and she did come back to boarding school in the 50s, late 50s, whereas we actually came back to England just before independence. And she told me about her life in a British boarding school at that time, and so really that was where I got a lot of the details of that.
Horrible, horrible details.
Yeah, not very nice.
No. So, what's interesting is that, loosely the story is a married woman with two children during the emergencies comes back to her home. She'd been nursing a sick friend. She comes back to her home. Her children and husband are gone. And the awful thing is things transpire to make both the elder daughter, and the mother believe that they will never see each other again.
Yes, part believe, part not believe, but certainly for a while,
Yeah,
and it is about, on the one hand, the mother's search for her missing daughters, and she is sent on a wild goose chase because there is another story underneath which she doesn't know about.
Yeah, there's numerous stories underneath. Wrapped up in the whole emergency situation and other machinations at work that she, were only found out later.
There was a lot of intelligence going on at the time. There was a lot of spying. There was a lot of, you didn't know who you could trust, that sort of thing, because that's how the British won. All sorts of people were involved in it, and although to actually turn the Chinese terrorists, I use the word terrorists because that's what they were called by the British, to turn them towards the end when they were tired and not really winning. That's when Asian agents really kind of went undercover rather than Brits because they couldn't have done it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of how sort of that front of the Cold War was fought.
Yeah.
You know, that was the sort of Chinese front of that.
Yeah.
But very interesting.
So definitely all that's going on. But I mean, it is about the end of empire. It isn't about preserving the colonial world.
No.
And all the characters who really are embedded or entrenched in more colonial attitude as the empire crumbles. Well, it already crumbled, really, when the Japanese invaded unthinkably and won Singapore, but before, you know, during the Second World War. But as it crumbles, so do the characters who are most entrenched in colonial attitudes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So although somebody did say she thought the British had got off too lightly, at a shabby time in their history. I don't think it was the shabbiest time in their history, actually. I think it was prior, really, when the Chinese and the Tamil workers were brought over and heavily exploited, really. But in some ways it's quite subtle. It's not, you know, shouted out. But empire does crumble, and so do the characters most entrenched in colonial attitudes.
Yes. They're sort of undone by it. Yeah. By their need for it as well. You know,
yeah.
They can't survive without it. And one of the things that is so gut-wrenching, a mother losing her children.
Yeah.
And you write so powerfully about that. And I was wondering if, I think I understand that there's been an aspect of that in your life.
That's right. I mean, my son at the age of 14 got on a friend's motorbike at a private school and went through a glass door. He's got an artery in his neck, the carotid artery, and he bled to death. So, yeah, and I saw the scene sort of while it was just minutes after it had happened because I was very nearby. So it was pretty horrendous and, you know, something like that impacts very heavily on your life. It isn't something you get over in 5 minutes. And so really, I always knew once I started to write that I wanted to write about loss, but I didn't want it to be my loss or anything similar to my loss, but I wanted to sort of draw on what it had been like to be able to write the book. So really, the theme of loss and all my mum's photograph albums really came together in the separation, because it isn't only a separation between Lydia and her daughter Emma, it's also a separation for Emma, her separation from the land where she was born and the place that she loved. And that's true for me too. And it was as if when we came back to England that Malaya had never happened.
Mm.
And I, for a long time, I felt really like an outsider in England. You know, when we came, I was this sort of blonde, curly-haired creature with a tan who didn't fit in for quite some time and really always felt slightly on the outside because of that. But going back to the loss, So the separation is about loss. It's not quite the loss we think it is at the beginning, and I did draw on my own experience to do that. And certainly in the second book, which is Penguin and International Publishers are publishing it next year, it's called The Tea Planter's Wife, and it's set in Ceylon between 1925 and 1934. And again, it's a little bit before independence there, but the colonial world is crumbling in a different way, and it's a different story, but there is a theme of loss in a very different way.
Mm.
Radio Gorgeous supports women. Women support Radio Gorgeous.
Because you only started writing relatively recently. What moved you to start writing?
I started soon after my 60th birthday, and actually I wrote a different book, first of all, which I call My Learning Experience. In truth, they're all a learning experience. I mean, you know, maybe if you get to 10 novels, you might feel you've got it. But I think, to some extent, every writer, to a greater or lesser extent, will think that you're only as good as the last book you wrote. Sort of thing. And my feeling now is I started at age 60. I've written, the second book I wrote is the Separation, and it's the one that's been bought. The first book attracted the interest of an agent, but didn't go any further than that. So, yeah, I've got a make up for lost time. So I'm trying to get a few books done quickly.
And so you come back to England at the age of 8,
yeah.
And you've had numerous adventures since then. And I did read somewhere that you lived in a commune at one point.
Yeah.
With your children?
I lived in the commune in the 1970s, and it was a funny old commune because actually it was with a rock and, what they used to call a rock and roll band, and I had my second child there, my daughter there, and the commune was actually owned by two brothers who were related to the Queen, and whose great-grandfather was George V. So it was a funny old mix because there was aristocracy and, you know, quite sort of well-to-do. You can't get much.
No.
And then there was the rest of us who really weren't like that at all. And, you know, it was a very unequal place. But having said that, it was, you didn't think about that at the time. You hardly even were aware. You sort of knew who they were, but it didn't. It was just so not interesting.
Uh-huh.
It was so not relevant. What was relevant was the music and the gigs and the kids and the life, you know. So, yeah, I also worked for an Italian countess at one point in Italy, San Gimignano, as an au pair. Yeah, and I lived in a 16th century village in Andalusia for 5 years, close to the border with Portugal. That was recent. We only came back to England, I think it was 4.5 years ago now. But, yeah, in fact, I started writing my first book there because in the crash of 2008, we lost our life savings in the financial crisis. It just happened to be the way things were invested, and it mm-hmm. went very badly for us. And so we were faced with, at the age of 60, you know, what do you do, really? And that's when I thought, right, I'm going to write. I had been thinking of writing a novel for a little while. My mum always used to say to me, you're such a great storyteller, you should write. And I never thought, it didn't occur to me that I could, until much, much later. And that's when I wrote that first book, which is the learning experience book.
Mm. And what's that, I mean, obviously you've had the experience of, you know, your life being one way one day.
And then
completely, you know, yeah. Other, you know, literally in the next minute. And so this was, I mean, you sort of have the resources to pull through, you know, but it's different at 60 and it's different when it's, how has that changed the dynamics of your relationship, or has it, or?
Well, my husband now is my second husband.
Mm-hmm.
My first husband and I had already parted by the time my son died.
Mm-hmm.
It changed my relationship with my daughter. I think it meant that we really, you know, we really, you know, we don't take anything for granted
mm-hmm.
at all, not mm-hmm. at all. That thing about it changing from 1 minute, that's very hard to get your head around.
Mm.
That was the hardest thing. And although I, you know, I have, and I did move on from my son's death, and there is actually an article in Mail on Sunday, You magazine, on the May 25th, all about Jamie's death, and it was absolutely harrowing to write it, but it did me good to do it. And also, in a funny way, returning to the theme of malaria in this book also helped, because it took me back to a time before my son even existed,
mm.
and it gave me back a part of myself, which I think was very healing, although I never, you know, never set out to do that. And the other most sort of healing aspects was the birth of my grandchildren. It was sort of, you know, the first one, and both, in fact, but, you know, they kind of fill up a space, in a way, a space that can never really be filled. And it was Jamie's birthday on the 10th of May. He would have been 43. And I don't often sort of, I think of him, of course, and he's part of my life. His death and his life are both part of my life, and always will be, and I always will be left with a profound sense of, how could that happen? How did that happen? How come he was there and then he wasn't?
Mm-hmm.
And that part of it, you know, when you mostly you can't spend your life focusing on him, because you couldn't live.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do focus on him, for some reason, a trigger or something, and I really see him visually, really see him, see the actual colour of his eyes and the way he smiled and the way his hair was and the colour of his skin, so fully realised as if he was standing in the room with me, then the shock is still there, that shock of, but he's gone, how could that be? And I don't think that'll ever actually completely go, because it kind of lives there alongside the fact that he's gone.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
It does. It does. Yeah. Well, you've told us what's next already.
I know.
I'm so excited. No, I'm totally excited.
There is a little bit at the end of the separation where there's a page all about the tea planter's wife. And I actually love the tea planter's wife, and I hope it does well, because in a way it's quite different from the separation, because the separation I did draw on my my childhood, and the tea planter's wife I didn't, so it's different.
Mm. Did but you have to do
with a theme or a really dramatic and emotionally devastating central story, you know?
Because it wasn't. It's not based on your information. Did you have to do a lot more research than you did?
It's funny, you know, people ask you sort of how you came to sort of write the book. And I did do some research on Blair. I did research the emergency and things like that, but I didn't go there because I didn't, as you said, I wanted to preserve the memories. With the tea planter's wife, I actually stayed on a tea plantation in the Misty Hill country beside a lake, which is exactly where my book is set. So, and of course I went to Sri Lanka, it's not Ceylon anymore, and that was wonderful, and they had the most brilliant library, so I did a lot of research there, books I'd never found here, so that was very good. And the third book, I have actually been to Vietnam, and it was very hard to find the past in Vietnam, actually. I had to really search for it.
Mm.
With the tea planter's wife, I listened to tapes primarily, tapes from, I think it was Cambridge University School of Oriental Studies or something like that, and they had these tapes of rubber planters talking about their lives there in the 1930s, and the voices were just so typical of what they would have sounded like and the attitudes they would have had. In fact, I had to turn it down a bit because a modern readership probably wouldn't have swallowed it.
Wow, yeah.
In fact, it's quite funny because there is a very strong love story in The Tea Planter's Wife, and during the first edit, my publisher at Penguin said, oh, I think we need to see more of their physical attraction, so can you turn that up a little bit? So I wrote this really fully full-blooded sex scene at the end of the first chapter, and she came back to me and said, oh my God, I think it's gone a little bit too far. So I had to suggest it a little bit more.
Down, girl, down.
Exactly. I quite enjoyed it, actually. I thought it was rather good.
Yeah, well, you can have a sideline in erotica. You know. All right, well, I'm looking forward to reading that because I really enjoyed The Separation. Thank you so much for being so generous.
My pleasure.
I appreciate
Absolutely.
That.
My pleasure.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?